Batch number 17181, Real One.
Mr. Unwin, Real One, where were you born, please?
I was born in Liverpool.
Which year was this?
In 1920.
Did you go to school in Liverpool?
Yes, I did. I went to the Liverpool Collegiate, a secondary school in Liverpool.
How old were you when you left there?
I was 17.
So that would have been 37?
In 37.
To do what?
I joined a local manufacturing company in Liverpool as a clerk.
What were they manufacturing?
They manufactured camping equipment, and they were wholesalers in oilskin clothing. It was quite a wide range of clothing and camping equipment.
Were you doing that when war was declared?
I was.
What was your reaction when you heard, if you heard, Chamberlain broadcast declaring war on Germany?
I'd just been called up. To give a little background to that point, I joined the Territorials in early in 1939. In 38, there was a crisis when war was expected, and a lot of chaps in the company joined the Territorials, and I wanted to join my father's regiment, which was the 6th Kings Liverpool. They were full, and they had a long, long waiting list. And in 1939, I decided I would try to join my uncle's regiment, a medium regiment of artillery. And this was the 59th, I'm sorry, the 59th medium regiment artillery. And I joined that regiment. They were taking fellows, they were taking volunteers as fast as the volunteers came, and they went far above their establishment. And when there were sufficient, they formed a daughter regiment, which was my regiment, the 68th Medium. And I was called up on probably on the 1st of September. And on the 3rd of September, we set off to a little village in Cheshire, Tattenhall. And we unloaded from the coaches which had taken us there, and I was sitting in a little passageway alongside the house in which we were going to be billeted. And it was at that point that Chamberlain made his speech declaring war. And we heard it. Not sure how we heard it, but I know that we did hear it. I was outdoors. It seems a little odd in those days, but nevertheless, I knew at that time. And then I realised, well, this is real.
Did you have a sense of dismay?
Did I have
a sense of dismay?
I don't recall that. We the dismay may have come in the act of being called up. It didn't seem to go much deeper once war was actually declared.
What type of skills were you learning with this unit at that time?
I became a surveyor, artillery surveyor.
What did that involve?
It's the lining, it's the control of the finishing point is to land the shells on the target, and the guns can't do this without some guidance. And we worked in four-gun troops, so we were 6-inch howitzers. We had four guns. Each gun had a dial sight on it, and I had an instrument like a theodolite, but known as a director. And I laid this director on the the line of fire of the guns, and then passed the angle to each of the four guns, and they put the reverse angle on and laid their guns in all parallel to each other. And there were other things. There were things like the angle of sight. We had to take that into consideration. If the target was 300 foot higher than the gun position, then that had to be taken into account. The range had to be taken into account. And it was the specialists, the people known as specialists, that did this. We took into account meteorological conditions. We got these from whichever theatre this was, we got the meteorological conditions for the area and took this into account. So we guided the guns onto the target.
Was there any question of your going to France with the BEF?
There was. The 59th, our parent unit, went immediately, and they sent all the under-19s back home, and I was those people sent back to England were replaced by people from our regiment, and I was on the list to go. This must have been in late 1939, but people, I think I was 19. It must have been people under 20 were taken off the list. Anyway, I was taken off the list and didn't go with them.
So
carrying on, was there any possibility of going to France? This came up at the time of Dunkirk. We had our marching orders for France at the time of Dunkirk, and 3 weeks after Dunkirk, we were still going to France. The advance party actually left, and I think they went somewhere around Brest way, and the rest of the unit were to follow. But this coincided with the collapse of France by 3 weeks after D-Day, and once that happened, we didn't go. So there were two occasions when we were bound for France. But I didn't, in fact, go.
So were you in Britain during the invasion scare?
Yes, I was in Britain until September, October maybe, of 1940. And our duties then were usually covering airfields prior to any expected parachute drops. If paratroops dropped on an airfield, we had that particular airfield lined up for immediate targets.
Did you have any attacks from the German Air Force?
No, we were never attacked.
So in autumn 1940 you went abroad?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that posting?
Yes, I went. It was a traumatic time, because my sister, we were four children. My youngest sister was an evacuee and was going to Canada, and the ship was torpedoed, and my sister was lost. I got a telegram from my parents, asked if I could have home leave. And they said, we're terribly sorry, but we're under orders. We might go today, we might go tomorrow. So, sad though we are, you can't go. Well, I just went. And I hitchhiked home from High Wycombe to Liverpool. I got home in the middle of the night, and there was an air raid on. My parents were in a shelter. And news came back early in the morning. My brother arrived from somewhere near High Wycombe, and that day news came through that my sister wasn't amongst the survivors. And the following day, I agreed with my parents that there was no point in my staying any further, and I left to go back to High Wycombe. And my father was a grocer, and about an hour after I left, the military police arrived at the shop looking for me, but I'd gone. And I went back. Nothing was done to me. I went on a charge in the normal way, and they sympathized with me, they expressed their sympathy. The major, the commanding officer of the battery was a Major Laird, Peter Laird of Camel Laird, a local man. And he said how sorry he was, but they would not do anything if I promised not to go again. So I promised this. And the next day, we set off for Liverpool as a unit to embark for the Middle East. So it was a very difficult time.
On the voyage out, did you run into the enemy?
No, we didn't. We had no trouble from the enemy. I think the ship went right across almost to the States before it turned south. And then we touched in a free town. That was our first port of call. But we didn't berth. We stayed in a sort of a harbour, river mouth harbour, for a day or so, then set sail for Cape Town, where we did stay for about 3 days, and then went straight after 3 days in Cape Town. The local people were very hospitable to us, and we sailed around through the Indian Ocean to Port Tufik.
What happened to you in Egypt?
In Egypt, we went into a little desert camp outside Cairo, and we were booked to go to Abyssinia. The Abyssinian campaign was warming up, and we were booked to go to Abyssinia, and our guns were sent off for camouflage, and the camouflage for Abyssinia was a startling colours. It was red and yellow, and the barrels had shapeless sort of lines of red and yellow on them. The vehicles were the same. And there were two medium regiments at the time. There was a 64th medium, a London territorial unit, and the 68th Liverpool territorial unit. And the 64th were going to the desert, and the 68th to Abyssinia. But for some reason, a battery of each regiment was transposed to the other regiment. So when regimental headquarters and the other battery of our regiment went to Abyssinia, they took with them a battery of the 64th. And we joined regimental headquarters of the 64th with their other battery, and we went into the Western Desert. And the odd thing about this is that we landed in the Western Desert with camouflage for Abyssinia, which we stuck out like sore thumbs right through the campaign.
Did you take part in Wavell's famous push?
Yes. We joined, I think it was about, it was mid-December that we went into the desert. And the troops hadn't at that time, Mersema Trew had been taken, I think, by New Zealanders a month or so before. And the Australians had come in, the 6th Australian Div. They had come in and they had moved up almost to the Libyan border. In fact, it took us 3 or 4 days to get up to the fighting zone, and by the time we got there, the Australians had crossed the border. So our first assignment for the unit was in the attack on Bardia, the first real battle of that campaign. And this was an easy sort of thing. Looking back on it, it was a one-way battle. We simply surrounded Bardia, and on a given date, I think it was January the 3rd of 1940, we took part in a barrage on the defences, and the town fell that day. And this set the scene for the campaign through Libya. Having completed the taking of of Bardia, Western Desert Forces then moved up to Tobruk and repeated the same exercise there, surrounded the place, a barrage, and took it on the same day. Fighting never lasted any long period. And Derna was the next place. And then Benghazi. There was a little bit of skirmishing sort of fighting in between Derna and Benghazi. Places that come to mind are D'Annunzio. I think maybe it was Gabriele D'Annunzio, an Italian fellow. A town had been named after him. And Barce on the escarpment just before Benghazi. And while we were still at Barce, Benghazi fell. The Italians fled from Benghazi, and we moved into the town unopposed. And at that point, the leading troops were going at such a rate, the Italians were going at such a rate with the leading troops on their heels, that it was thought there was no further need for medium artillery. So from Benghazi, we returned into Egypt.
Did your unit take any casualties in this push?
There were surprisingly few casualties. As I said, it was a one-way campaign. Casualties were more like there was not stage fright, but people were stiffened with fear. That sort of thing was common during these barrages. When particularly the barrage of the attack on Tobruk, there was some preliminary shelling of the Italian defences, and this was often done at night. And we moved into forward position. Guns moved into forward positions for this for these exercises, just harassing fire during the night. And on one of those cases, I remember one or two fellows became stiff, just simply froze. But there were not a lot of casualties. I don't recall many casualties.
Was it just the sound of the artillery pieces?
It must have been, yes. There was no return fire. We were not under shell fire ourselves.
So how long did this stiffening last?
Well, I don't remember. The traps I remember, I was in, we were two troops, C Troop, Charlie Troop, and Don Troop, each having four guns, and we both operated at the same time. And this stiffening was in fellows with Don Troop. I was Charlie Troop myself. In our four guns, I can't recall any casualties.
But these were not permanent disablement?
No.
What about Italian prisoners? Were you taking many of those?
I saw lots and lots of prisoners. They, as we were on the outskirts of the town, these 6-inch howitzers were quite a short-range piece, really. 12 or 14,000 yards was the furthest they would normally fire. So we were, although we were not in the immediate vicinity of any enemy troops, it wasn't far away. And when the prisoners were taken, they were usually brought out of the area and filed across the desert in seemingly endless lines, thousands of them, with just a small number, smattering of British troops or Australian troops, walking alongside them.
What was the demeanour of the prisoners?
They were pretty hangdog. We didn't. There was no exchange of conversation. They did walk past right alongside us on one or two occasions, and they looked dejected. I can see now fellows walking past. They were fairly untidy-looking troops, the Italians. Their uniform was a scruffy sort of thing. Their overcoats were never trimmed off at the bottom. This sort of thing looked, and their hats looked sloppy. They looked a pretty awful lot.
Did they speak to the British troops?
I don't recall anybody speaking at all.
Were they treated properly?
Oh, there was no hassle at all given to them. They were not causing any trouble. They were being told to march along, and they did march along. And there were scarcely any British troops walking along with them. They had no alternative. This, in a further 18 months, this happened to me. I suffered this myself. So I know the... I learned the feelings of the Italians.
So, to pick up the campaign, what happened next?
Well, from Benghazi, we set off back for Egypt, and we went to... we first went to a camp... I think we must have gone to... We went to a camp called Mina, which was right by the pyramids. And there was a... in the desert, there was this mixed-up medium regiment, which I belonged, part 64th, part 68th. There was also a regular medium unit, the 7th medium. And, I mentioned before that we had 6-inch howitzers. That was in our training in England, and they were just drill-purpose guns. They couldn't fire. But when we were equipped in the Middle East, we had 60-pounders. They were 4.5 guns, which fired a 60-pounder shell. And they were long toms. They had a barrel about 21 feet long. I think they were a First World War gun that had been converted one way or another. And we had these. And I was wrong when I said our 6-inch howitzers only fired 12,000 yards, because we had 4.5s and they fired up to about 22,000 yards. But it was thought fitting that these guns, which were probably superior to the 6-inch howitzers, should be given to the 7th medium, and we would take the 6-inch howitzers that they had. So the two units swapped their arms, and both units set off for Greece. This was just before Easter in 1941.
That included you?
That included me, yes.
What was the voyage to Greece like?
The voyage to Greece was strange. We went on two... The guns went off by themselves. The guns with an escorting party left Alexandria a day or two prior to our departure. And when the men of the regiment travelled, we travelled on two little Greek steamers, which were, looking back on it now, it's quite comical. They hardly looked seaworthy, and there was no accommodation. Everybody just stayed on deck. There was a small cabin down below, which was filled all the time. But there was at night time, the whole deck was filled. There was no moving around on the deck at night. Was quite difficult, because the whole deck was sleeping space. And they were seaworthy. They got us there, but they weren't very... They didn't give you much confidence in them. They were that sort of ship. And at one time, there were one or two guns, machine guns, Lewis guns or Bren guns, as anti-aircraft defense on them. And they were given the orders to exercise, to test their firing a day or so out from Alexandria. And even a small thing like a number of machine guns going off seemed to have quite an effect on the ship. But nevertheless, they got us there. And we sailed into Piraeus a day or so after leaving Alexandria.
Any reception from the Greeks themselves?
No, we had no reception from the Greeks. We were taken to we were taken to a dispersal area. There was a tented camp ready for us. We moved straight into these camps. It was rather near the present-day airport in Athens, against the foothills of the mountains or hills just outside Athens. And we spent about 2 days at the most, two, maybe 3 days. And during this time, this ludicrous thing of our... That's funny. We didn't have the same guns. But the guns which we took, the 6-inch howitzers which we took, went off for camouflage, for Greek surroundings. And they went down, I think they went to the airport, and they were sprayed there. And as soon as that was done, we set off for northern Greece. We were all given a free day in Athens, and we went into Athens just for a day. But it was a very short stop.
Did you get the impression the Greeks welcomed your presence or not?
Oh, this was very, very evident. In this, I said we went into Athens on one day, and during the Libyan campaign, the first Libyan campaign, we'd come across for the first time water shortage, and there was a very, very small ration of water each day. So it was very soon after we'd gone into the desert in the first place, instructions were given that nobody would shave. And we could shave each time a town fell. So we shaved at Bardia, we shaved at Tobruk, and so on along the desert. And most of us had grown a little moustache. And this is just a comic sort of incident. We went into town, and we all needed a haircut, tidying up. And I'd grown this little moustache, which was hardly noticeable. I was only about 20 at the time. And the barber did my hair, and having done my hair, he indicated, should he trim my moustache? And I was terribly proud of this, that he'd recognised I had one. that was our day in Athens. But we met friendship from all the people in Athens. And then on another of the 2 or 3 days we were there, we wandered off into the hills, and we came to a little taverna at which we first tasted the Greek wine. Remember a nice wine called Mavrodaphne, and we got a terrific welcome from the fellow in this taverna. Then we set off for northern Greece, but it was here that the feelings of the Greeks became apparent, because this was the day we set off for Greece, for northern Greece. I remember an officer saying, "We're going quite near Delphi." And this meant nothing to me at the time, but now I'm terribly interested in all these things. I've been to Delphi, and I must have been terribly green at that time. But our first day's travelling north was the day prior to Greek Independence Day, sometime in March, I think, March the 25th, maybe. And the practice of the Greeks, it seemed, had been that all the country people, walked into the town for the festivities the day before the Independence Day, and they returned home the day after. And this day we were travelling was the